I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, our conversation today, is cancer contagious? Well, it is among the dog-like Tasmanian devils, but what about humans? But first, the White House is acknowledging what it calls a sober moment today as the number of U.S. troops killed in Iraq climbed to 4,000. That mark was reached yesterday when four soldiers in southern Baghdad were killed in a roadside bombing, the same day that at least 61 Iraqis were killed nationwide, and several people inside the Green Zone were wounded in rocket attacks. Today, President Bush is receiving an update on the situation in Iraq from Commanding General David Petraeus. For the latest, we turn to Dmitry Sevastopoulou, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times. And Dmitry, let's start with General Petraeus. He's made comments today accusing Iran of being behind that attack on the Green Zone, in that Iran trained the fighters and added accelerants to their rockets that would make them even more devastating. His accusations of Iran training fighters going into Iraq is not new.
No, it's not new, Robin. General Petraeus and other senior commanders have on many occasions claimed that Iran was both training and supplying weapons to militant groups in Iraq. It has to be said, though, they don't produce a lot of evidence to back this up, but they have made these claims many, many times.
Well, the meeting today between the president and General Petraeus over a secure video link comes as we hear, and I think you and I spoke, of General Petraeus wanting a slowdown in the long-awaited summer drawdown of troops in Iraq. There's been some troop reduction. Now a call for a pause this summer.
Well, basically what's happened is, if you remember last year, President Bush authorized a surge of about 30,000 troops. Most of those troops will come out of Iraq by this summer. And General Petraeus is expected to recommend to the president that the U.S. then pauses any further withdrawals to assess whether taking those surge troops out will allow violence to creep back up again, or whether they can contain the violence at the lower level of troop numbers.
And how is President Bush expected to react to these recommendations?
Well, in public comments so far over the past few months, he suggested that he would do whatever General Petraeus said. But I think a key meeting will be more on Wednesday than today. On Wednesday, he's going to hear from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and they are very concerned about the stress levels on the force, the long deployments, the number of repeated deployments that is putting pressure on and stress on families. And I think unless the Joint Chiefs can persuade him on Wednesday that he needs to reconsider, I suspect he will go for the pause idea.
Well, and what more is the White House or the U.S. military, or even General Petraeus, if he's said anything yet, saying today about this terrible benchmark, the 4,000 U.S. troops now killed in Iraq?
Well, I think, to be honest, the media pays more attention to the benchmarks than the military. They will always say that each death is just as terrible as any other death, and that a 4,000 mark is no different from a 3,000 mark or 2,977. But it does give a time for everyone to look at the number of people who have died. It's also important to point out that the number of casualties doesn't get mentioned very often. There's almost 30,000 soldiers who've been injured, and many of those in previous battles would have been killed, but with the modern improvements in body armor and the increased ability to medevac them back to the U.S., a lot of people who would have died before are actually surviving with pretty horrific injuries.
Well, and this comes again as the debate is over how long troops who are in Iraq will stay there and how many may be sent there. If General Petraeus receives the pause in withdrawing troops he's expected to ask for, will that have any effect on the deployments of troops there now? For instance, will troops who surged in last year be asked to stay longer than the 15 months they're already staying?
No, the surge troops will come out. The question is, when other troops go into Iraq, will they be going for 12 months or will they be going for 15 months? And that calculation depends on what level of overall troops there are in Iraq. And I think until we know how long the pause is going to be, we're not going to know the answer to that question.
Dmitry Sevastopoulou, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times. Dmitry, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
To our conversation today about contagious cancer. About a decade ago, on the Australian island of Tasmania, biologists began to notice something that disturbed them. The population of the island's signature animal, the Tasmanian devil, was dropping dramatically, and the reason for the decline, frankly, surprised them. Tasmanian devils, marsupials about the size of a large dog, are dying of cancer, and it's a cancer that is being spread through physical contact. In other words, the cancer is contagious. It's terrible news for the Tasmanian devil, which has no immunity to the disease, and biologists predict it may soon be extinct. But what does this discovery mean for humans? Well, it's shedding new light on our knowledge of how cancer spreads. Author David Quammen traveled to Tasmania to investigate. He writes about what he found in the April issue of Harper's Magazine and joins us from Yellowstone Public Radio in Bozeman, Montana, to talk about it. David, welcome.
Thanks, Robin. Good to be with you.
And I want to be clear right at the start. We know, for instance, that cervical cancer is spread sexually, but it's spread by a virus that then may or may not develop into cancer. With these Tasmanian devils, you're talking about cancer causing cancer.
Exactly right, Robin. This is a line of tumor cells which are themselves transmissible from one individual to another. It's something that is not supposed to be possible, at least in the general understanding of cancer.
Right.
The general understanding is that cancer is not an infectious disease, but turns out that under some circumstances, it can be.
Well, you do write about a sexually transmitted sarcoma that affects dogs, Syrian hamster lab experiments where scientists found that, what, healthy hamsters put in a cage with cancerous hamsters could contract cancer?
That's right. That was an experiment that was done a couple decades ago at the National Cancer Institute. They developed a tumor in a lab strain of hamsters known as the Syrian hamster. It started as a normal tumor in one hamster, and then they extracted it, injected it into another hamster, ran it through a series of what are called passages, injecting it, seeing a tumor grow in the next hamster, taking cells, injecting it into another. And after a dozen or so of those passages, they had a tumor that could pass on its own from one hamster to another. It reached the point where it was passing from one hamster to another, despite the fact that they were separated from each other by a cage screen.
It was a cancer that evolved.
It was a cancer that evolved. It's one of the things I got into with this subject, the fact that there is an evolutionary biology of cancer. Cancer is an evolving disease.
Well, that's a frightening thought when you take it to its full conclusion. But let's talk about, you know, what you learned. The Tasmanian devils, you went out to see them with researchers. How is their cancer showing up in them?
It's a facial cancer. In fact, it's called devil facial tumor disease because it manifests primarily as these large lumps, these growths, these tumors on the faces of these poor animals, the devils. Now, one thing that's an important fact about the Tasmanian devil is that although they're not really devilish animals, they're really, really kind of charming creatures,
They
have this trait of biting one another in the face. It happens accidentally when they're scrapping over carcasses. They live mainly as scavengers on kangaroos and other dead animals. They bite one another when the males are competing for mates, and the males and females even bite one another during the mating process. So there's all this facial biting. And in the meantime, these growths, these tumors, are there on the faces, and the largest of the tumors tend to get crumbly, almost like feta cheese, and it seems that tumor cells are being broken off or falling off the tumors of one animal into the facial wounds of another, taking root there, and that seems to be the way the disease is passing.
I just want to stay with these animals for a second because these researchers who are trying to save them, well, they seemed really touched by the fact that they're getting to know them. They're going out there and caging them to see which ones have it. But they then have to remove the animals that have the cancers from the population because it's so contagious.
That's right. Yeah, I spent some time in the field with a young woman named Chrissy Puck, who is a trapper for the disease control trials in eastern Tasmania. And she runs a trap line of 40 or so traps, catches these animals, re-catches them, tags them, checks them over, gives them names. There's Rudolph, there's Captain Bly, there's Noddy, there's Hipster. She comes to know these animals as individuals, and then she has to make the decision, does this one look like it's carrying? Does this little wound here, does this little pink spot on its lip represent tumor or not? If she thinks it's clean, then she releases the animal. if she thinks it has even the beginnings of the disease, then she keeps it and another veterinarian euthanizes it, and then it goes through this whole pathology chain of evidence.
Because they've got to get to the bottom and try to save the animals that are still uninfected with the cancer. Well, I want to go back to the few stories there are of contagious cancer. There's the case of the woman with melanoma whose mother agreed to be injected with her daughter's cancer cells in an experiment that took place some 40 years ago. What happened then?
It was a 50-year-old woman with abdominal cancer. The doctors treating her as an experiment that they thought might be helpful in learning about immune reactions to cancer, injected her healthy 80-year-old mother with tumor cells from the daughter. Then the daughter promptly died of other causes, and the mother was not immediately taken back to the surgical table to have that cancer implant removed. Some weeks were allowed to pass. By the time they did go back in, it was too late. The cancer had metastasized, and about a year and a half later, the mother died essentially of the daughter's cancer.
And there are other cases of tumor transmission, doctors who have accidentally infected themselves by, through needles.
Right. For instance, a 53-year-old surgeon, this is also in the medical literature, cuts his palm while he's doing abdominal surgery on a cancer patient, and a few months later, he discovers that he's got a tumor growing in his palm, representing the same line of cancer cells that he had taken out of the patient. He was treated successfully with surgery, and there's another case that goes back farther, 1920. A medical student named Henry Vadon jabbed himself with a syringe, received cancer from a woman who had been treated for breast cancer. He essentially got breast cancer of the hand and eventually died of it.
You say in some of the cases that we know of where tumors have been passed from human to human, some of the recipients and some of the original sources of the tumors were genetically similar. What does that tell us?
Well, in some cases, genetically similar, certainly with the mother and daughter. With the medical accidents, not necessarily genetically similar.
Mm.
But it is something that makes it more possible. For instance, tumors are sometimes carried in organ transplants. And when an organ transplant is done, you try and get a good match, and then you treat the organ recipient with immunosuppressive drugs so that his body or hers doesn't reject that transplant. Well, if the transplanted liver or kidney happens to be carrying tiny incipient tumors, the immunosuppressive drugs give those tumors a chance to take hold. So that's another instance in which cancer can be transplanted from one human to another.
That's David Quammen. His story, Contagious Cancer, The Evolution of a Killer, appears in the April edition of Harper's Magazine. We want to, again, stress this is rare, but he and others are on the trail of contagious cancers. And it comes in handy that David is an expert on Charles Darwin. When we come back, we'll hear about Darwinism in cancer cells. And later, to Detroit, where the city's mayor and his former aide face several charges of perjury and other counts after their text messaging scandal. Back in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with more from David Quammen. He traveled to Tasmania to investigate the plight of the dog-like Tasmanian devil. The animal's population is being decimated by a rare case of contagious cancer, tumors passed from one animal to another through physical contact with the face. And biologists say it's likely that that species will be extinct in the next few decades. Well, David, let's talk more about how cancer cells might be evolving. We know the human body has trillions of cells. They divide throughout our lifetime. And yes, we have a number of mechanisms to fight cancer. We can repair mutated DNA, for example. And there are body cells that target and destroy cancer cells. But have cancer cells evolved to the point that they're now fighting back?
Yes. One of the things we're learning is that there is an evolutionary biology of cancer, that tumors have the capacity to evolve almost the way species evolve. There was a scientific paper published back in the 1970s by a fellow named Peter Nowell. The title of this was The Clonal Evolution of Tumor Cell populations, a fancy title for describing the idea that groups of cells in a tumor have a certain genetic diversity, compete against one another, and evolve just the way the individual members of a population of animals compete against one another and the species evolves. That was an idea that was just sort of tossed out there by this fellow. There wasn't much experimental support from it, but in recent years there has been some very interesting work, and I ran across some of it as I was getting interested in the Tasmanian situation. And this work, some of it done by a fellow named Carlo Maley at the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia, shows experimentally that, yes, it's true, the cells within a tumor represent a population of variant individuals that can evolve toward more and more aggressive forms of tumor.
Well, but the idea of cancer leaping from one face to another, you know, as it apparently is in the Tasmanian devil population. We should say that in the human population, cancer almost always affects individuals. It arises from within. It's partly genetic, partly environment. We don't really know, but we do know that at least right now, cancer is not contagious in the human population. And we just, I feel we need to say that, you know, for the millions of people living with
that's
cancer.
True. Yeah, that's important. This is a potentiality of cancer. It happens in the world as we know it only under very special circumstances in rare cases. And the case of the Tasmanian devil is important, interesting, and instructive because it tells us something about those special conditions.
And one of the things we learn is that cancer may be transmitted between the animals by something called allograft, a sort of almost a tissue transplant, like we heard about between the mother and the daughter. When these animals bite each other, they're actually also transferring this cancer cell line. What can we learn about how to stop these cells from evolving in ways that cancer might become contagious between humans?
Well, first of all, it's important to remember that the Tasmanian devil case is a very special situation. One of the things that's special about it is that the Tasmanian devil has a very small gene pool. Until this disease hit, the animal was abundant on the island. There were about 150,000 of these animals in the early 90s, but they had been through some reductions in population because they're unpopular, because ranchers hate them. They're essentially the coyotes or the wolves of Tasmania. They were almost driven extinct, but they bounced back from that because they're very opportunistic, very enterprising animals. So the population has bounced back, but the genetic diversity has not bounced back. It takes much longer for genetic diversity to be regained after a population bottleneck. And that seems to be a necessary condition for this strange, bizarre epidemic of transmissible cancer. The immune systems of the Tasmanian devils don't recognize these cancer cells as alien because the immune systems from one animal to another are so similar, essentially they can't tell him from me. So the tumor cells are passed and the immune systems of the devils give them a bye and they take hold and kill the animals.
Well, and we know that human populations that become very isolated and don't have a very expansive gene pool intermarry are also more susceptible to illness. So that seems to be the real clue there.
And yet there's this other strange case of the dog tumor, something called canine transmissible venereal tumor, which is a sexually transmitted cancer. It's something that's passed by physical contact during the act of mating among dogs. It's been known for more than 100 years in dogs around the world, and dogs around the world do not have a small gene pool.
Right.
And yet this tumor seems to be able to pass from one to another, because in this case, the tumor seems to have evolved ways of skirting, of eluding the immune systems of the different dogs.
Huh. Oh, that's fascinating. In the meantime, David Quammen, we are animal lovers here. Is the Tasmanian devil doomed? Are they going to be able to save the breed?
Well, it remains to be seen. They're very concerned. I talked with a scientist named Mena Jones, who has been working on this. She was one of the earliest scientists to see it on her study site back in 2001. And now she's involved in, they call it the Devil Facial Tumor Disease Project, to try and find a solution, find a defense against this. She told me that this disease could progress to the extinction of the Tasmanian devil within 25 years. The disease has already swept across 60% of the island. In some of those areas, it has reduced the population by about 90%. They're trying to stop it. They're doing that by culling sick animals, leaving healthy ones, trying to create some boundaries so that new sick animals cannot invade the areas where the healthy animals are. They've got a captive population of clean animals. They're talking about planting that population on a small offshore island from Tasmania. But that's controversial, too. They're working on a vaccine. They're working on everything they can think of to try and deal with this. But there is a chance that this disease could take the Tasmanian devil up to the brink of extinction, at which point any number of things might push it over the brink.
David Quammen, his article, Contagious Cancer, The Evolution of a Killer, is in the April issue of Harper's Magazine. For more, you can go to our website, here-now.org. And we understand, David, that you're off to Europe to do research for what may be your next book, investigating emerging diseases such as the Ebola virus and the way they travel. So hope to talk to you when you finish that research. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. Good to talk with you.
Okay, still to come today, the anti-war movement is embracing technology, so why isn't that bringing out more protesters when they get tweets from Twitter? That's later today, after the news, here and now. In Detroit today, Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy announced perjury and other charges against the mayor of Detroit and his former top aide in the text messaging case that has consumed the city for months.
In this case, we asked, number one, can we charge perjury? Yes. Two, are there other crimes and offenses that we can charge other than perjury? Yes. Should we charge? Yes.
This investigation began after reporters found text messages that seemed to show that Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick had a romantic relationship with his then Chief of Staff Christine Beatty. Both the mayor and the aide denied the relationship while testifying on a police whistleblower lawsuit last summer. Well, we have two updates from Detroit. First, Quinn Kleinfelter, city government reporter for Detroit Public Radio, WDET. Quinn, this whole case began when two police officers alleged they were fired for investigating claims that the mayor used his security detail to cover up extramarital affairs. In court, the mayor and his former top aide testified they did not have extramarital affairs. Then these text messages surfaced. What did they say?
Well, they indicate that, in fact, the mayor and his former chief of staff, now Christine Beatty, may have very well perjured themselves while under oath. They were asked specifically about whether or not they exchanged, not only whether or not they had an affair, but whether or not they'd exchanged messages via text to say that. And both denied that several times under oath. They also denied that they had worked or conspired in any way to try to remove some of the police officers that were beginning to investigate the situation. And it appears now from the text as well that that indeed was the case, and that they worked with people just below the chief of police to try and remove some of these former officers. And again, those seem to be the bases for what the prosecutor is filing today.
In fact, some more potentially damaging text messages leaked out over the weekend.
They did. Some that indicated, as I say, that a person just below the police chief in Detroit at the time, and this all stems to a number of years ago, may have actually worked with the former chief of staff to try to remove these police officers. It's hard in some ways to pin things down because much of it stems from a rumor, a party that supposedly was held where there may have been some involvement at the mayor's official mansion, the Manoogian Mansion, and also that there could have been some police involvement with a possible violence that may have occurred there. Now, the mayor has steadfastly said the party never, ever occurred. And in fact, the state's attorney general had investigated and said that there was nothing that he could find. However, these policemen were beginning to look at that situation when they were summarily basically fired, demoted back down very, very far. And since then, that was why they filed the suit, and that was why the city wound up having to pay $9 million, roughly, of taxpayers' money, because the city was actually defending the mayor as a official of the city government.
Well, and Quinn, we should say you are outside the mayor's office right now, awaiting what some expect to be an announcement from him. But what about the charges? I know they're lengthy. Can you sum them up?
Basically, they fall under whether or not the mayor actually committed perjury, as well as his former chief of staff, and whether they obstructed justice in trying to prove the perjury allegations. The prosecutor began some of her remarks by saying that they had had trouble themselves trying to get information, data, et cetera, from the city attorneys, and that in some cases it was possible that some of that material may have been destroyed. And because of that, the city and the prosecutor have been at odds in a number of manners, and it appears that there could be other charges filed, the prosecutor seemed to indicate, and you would think that that might stem into some of the other city official activities even below the mayor.
And we should say these charges against the mayor and his former top aide involve some potentially serious jail time.
They do. 5 years for a few of them, up to 15 years in prison for others. And, you know, not only the criminal penalties that the mayor and his former chief of staff may face, but also what it's doing to the city itself in terms of getting the business of the city done. It has, as you say, engulfed the city for a number of months now. And city officials, including the city council, have repeatedly said that it's impacting trying to do business in Detroit, not only whether or not people are looking a little bit away from coming to the city because they see this ongoing controversy, but also the city officials themselves, which should be putting together, for instance, the city budget in an area where the unemployment rate is higher than anywhere else in the nation and where job creation and trying to figure out what you do with scant city resources is a very telling task. And yet at the moment, they've been consumed with trying to figure out who's going to run government if, in fact, the mayor would step down, and the city council launching their own investigation into it.
Quinn Kleinfelter, city government reporter for Detroit Public Radio, WDET. Quinn, thanks so much.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, for more on how the city's reacting, Nolan Finley, editorial page editor of the Detroit News, joins us. And Nolan, the prosecutor went out of her way. She spoke at great length before listing the charges against the mayor and his former top aide about what a definition of a witness is and why it's important not to lie. We understand that all the talk in the pews this past Easter Sunday was about the mayor and whether or not this was private business and should not be part of a public investigation. Was she speaking to the people, directly to the people of Detroit?
She absolutely was. And she wanted to move this beyond a discussion of, well, he just lied about sex. And I think you saw in the breadth of the charges and the depth of the evidence she's bringing against him that it's much more than just lying about sex, that there was a pattern of deception here that involved a great deal of city money and encompassed a good number of city employees, it appears.
Well, and it comes at a time when, you know, the headlines just reverberate with bad news, not just, you know, economic news for the country, but especially for Detroit. We read today's headlines. Vacancy rates are up. The state is swamped by homeowner appeals for tax relief. So this is a layer over that.
It's a tragedy. It's the last thing Detroit needed. After decades of devastation, this city has begun to enjoy a bit of a rebound. Lots of investment downtown, starting to creep out into the neighborhoods. Until the housing bust, home values in Detroit were going up, new homes were actually being built, and now it's hard to see how anything can move ahead until this matter is behind us.
Well, it's tea leaf parsing at this point, and this is the latest in, you know, a series of scandals, as people in Detroit well know. But what's the sense of what might happen?
Well, I think people are waiting now to hear from the mayor. He's supposed to speak at any moment. And the great speculation is he going to actually try to be a criminal defendant and a sitting mayor at the same time? And if so, how he intends to pull that off? Because keeping himself out of jail is going to demand a great deal of his time and energy. We've already heard the prosecutor say that city employees under his direction, under his authority, were involved possibly in destroying evidence, in obstructing her investigation. Is he really in a position to continue to be mayor while this case unfolds? There's just a lot of questions we still to be answered.
Nolan Finley, editorial page editor of the Detroit News. Nolan, thanks so much for speaking to us about it.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And speaking of cities and politics and those stories that you just can't make up, we're going to speak with novelist and NPR host Scott Simon in the coming days, a story he did make up, but he said it was hard because he knew so much about the city of Chicago and its politics. We'll hear about his new novel about city politics in the next couple of days. Also, we'll speak to a lawyer and social activist bringing green jobs and technology to former brown fields in Oakland, California. That's in the days ahead. You're listening to Here and Now. It used to be that anti-war activists only had to say the word and thousands of people would turn out to protest. Well, now organizers are using mobilization techniques like Twitter, a micro-blogging service. And 1,000 people showed up in San Francisco last week after they got a tweet from Twitter. Anti-war organizer David Taylor used Twitter to mobilize peaceful protesters on the 5th anniversary of the War on Terror. They marched against the U.S. presence in Iraq. But why? With all this new technology, weren't there more marchers? David is an activist and the executive director of Radical Designs, which provides technical consulting to activists and nonprofit organizations. First of all, David, for those who don't know, what is Twitter?
Twitter is a website and SMS service that allows folks to send text messages to update friends about what they're doing on a daily basis. So if you're walking down the street, you see something interesting, you can use your cell phone to send a message out, and any of your friends that are following you will receive that message either by email, over Instant Messenger, or via text message.
And critics say that it can be just silly stuff, like I'm reading somebody writing that they love waking up on a friend's couch, someone else writing about a pet peeve, restaurants who let their water glass become empty. But it's also used, for instance, by presidential campaigns. John Edwards used it quite a bit, and here's a message that you can watch Barack Obama live and ask him a question. So it can be used to organize, and I presume that's how you're using it.
Yeah, we used it specifically to provide information to people on the day of our mass direct action in downtown San Francisco about different events that were happening throughout town. So we would announce when a group would start a civil disobedience at Chevron, when there was a die-in in Feinstein's office, and just let people know general information about safety situations during large protests and where folks were looking for support.
So you had, for instance, a die-in at Senator Dianne Feinstein's office, the thinking being that she and other Democrats hadn't done enough to stop the war in Iraq. I mean, why is Twitter better than, you know, sending out an email?
Well, Twitter's very useful for real-time information. When we were organizing this event, we used email, we used websites, we used flyers, all your traditional organizing methods. But we used Twitter very effectively on the day of civil disobedience and protest.
You said that it's more efficient to give people last-minute information than have hundreds of people milling around waiting for an action to start. And you also use Twitter to keep them up to date while an action is going on. You know, how best to maybe clear the area?
Yeah. We had 150 people that decided to participate in nonviolent civil disobedience on Wednesday. There were, you know, hundreds and hundreds more that came out to support those people but weren't feeling like they wanted to risk arrest in order to show their opposition to the war.
Well, what's, by the way, to stop a San Francisco policeman from getting on your service and following your every move?
Oh, we know that they were.
So you weren't being secretive. Well, you had 1,000 people, much less than a few years ago, much, much less than the 60s, when there were 500,000 people protesting in Washington in 1969, for instance, and there was no Twitter, no internet, no cell phones, no answering machines. There are a lot of reasons for less turnout today, but do you think, ironically, one could be that not everyone has Twitter? You're preaching to the choir.
Well, we're not trying to do outreach using Twitter. We put Twitter on all of our outreach materials for folks that are on the streets the day of to give them information then. But we use the same traditional organizing methods of phone calls and telling your friends and sending and passing out flyers. I mean, I think you don't have to go back to, you know, the 60s to find out when there were 500,000 people on the street. That happened, you know, 5 years ago, but the media really blacked it out. And I think that really disempowered large amounts of people who were active in the anti-war movement. I had them really focus on more pragmatic things, like electing a Democratic Congress to end the war.
Were you disappointed, though, with public opinion polls showing people so against the war in Iraq at this point, but so few people turning out? Why do you think there aren't more people out on the streets on something like the 5th anniversary?
I think people feel that it doesn't matter if they go onto the streets because the powers that be just aren't listening to them. And I think a lot of that energy is focused in electing an anti-war president.
Well, and if there are protests, one way Americans will find out about it will be through getting a tweet from Twitter.
Getting a tweet, getting a flyer on the streets, and getting an email.
Anti-war organizer David Taylor speaking to us from San Francisco. David, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Okay, in just 1 minute, we're going to hear why Keith Olbermann used to hang around Bob Elliott's studios when Keith was a kid. Now he's going to get to honor him. Why do so many comics point to Bob Elliott as the one who launched their career? That's in 1 minute, here and now. If you did a family tree of droll comics, it would wend its way back through David Letterman and Bob Newhart, back through Johnny Carson, to Bob and Ray. The comedy duo Bob and Ray was born on WHGH Radio right here in Boston in 1946. Bob Elliott was the DJ. Ray Goulding, who died in 1990, was the newscaster. And when the Red Sox games were delayed by rain, they began a banter that turned into a national act, the two playing a cast of over 100 characters, including the hapless journalist Wally Ballou.
This is radio's highly regarded Wally Ballou, winner of 16 Diction Awards.
Then there was Mary Magoon with her recipe for ginger ale salad and opinions on decorating.
I was rather disappointed in the somber decor of your studio today, and I wondered why.
Letterman, Leno, Kurt Vonnegut, Keith Olbermann were all fans, and Bob Elliott literally begat comic Chris Elliott, who will join his dad and Keith Olbermann in a panel discussion of the Bob and Ray Show next Monday in New York. In fact, it's kind of Bob Elliott month. His 85th birthday is Wednesday. So we thought we'd celebrate by revisiting our conversation with Bob Elliott when he was inducted into the New England Radio Hall of Fame last year. We thought his voice hadn't changed at all and asked if others said the same thing.
Yeah, they do, and I find it hard to believe. I get people that recognize me by voice. And
they do.
I usually slip into Wally Ballou before they talk very long.
Can you do a little? Where's Wally now?
Wally Ballou is right here next to Bob.
See, he never got his mic on in time, or the engineer didn't, to hear the wall part. It always came out Wally Ballou.
He made loyal fans out of a lot of engineers across the country.
How'd you do him? A sort of a nasally
thing? Yeah, kind of adenoidal, which I am to an extent, I guess. But he was based on somebody that worked at the station when all the characters were prototypes of people who were on the air at that time.
We want to listen to a little more from Wally Ballou. He's trying to broadcast a 4th of July parade.
Yeah, I remember that. Happened more than once.
Every time he's ping-ponging between himself and who's his colleague?
Artie Skerberhorn.
Right. Oh, and each time music. It goes back and forth, they've just missed voice, the Artie. Music. Let's listen.
Up at this end, Wally, we have a group of children parading by now, and there's, yes, a band in back of them. So, engineer, let's swing down. And same thing seems to have happened here, Wally. Back to your vantage point.
Enter luck next time, Artie Skerberhorn. Oh, wait a minute. There is a band now, and I think if we swing our parabolic microphone down, we'll catch it. A little bit.
A Bob and Ray skit as the hapless Wally Ballou tries to broadcast the 4th of July parade just as the band ends every time.
He was hapless in most everything he undertook.
That's right. Bob Elliott, were you aware that MSNBC's Keith Olbermann had copied your character, the worst person in the world?
Yes, I am, and I wrote Keith a thank you a couple of years ago. Our last series on WOR in New York in the 70s, I guess it was, Keith used to come up. His father used to bring him into the studio. He was, I don't know, early teens, I think.
Really?
And he would sit in and study what we did, and he was a fan even back then.
Well, now, he does do, as we said, the worst person in the world character.
Yeah.
He's also written a book of the same title.
Right.
Now, who was you, when you created the character, who was that supposed to be?
Well, we didn't let on for a long time. It was a character that would pop in and out of Mary Backstage, the soap opera we did.
Right, she was the noble wife, Mary Backstage.
And it happened after our Broadway show had received rave reviews from everybody except John Simon. So we finally got bold enough to say, well, yeah, to us the worst person in the world was John Simon because he really reamed us.
He was the New York Magazine theater reviewer.
He was at that time, and we liked the fashion newspaper. What is that?
Vogue?
Women's Wear Daily.
Oh, Women's Wear Daily.
We liked their review. They reviewed our suits.
But, well, what was the primary purpose? I mean, Keith also writes in his book about acknowledging you and your impact on him. It was funny, but he also, for instance, commends your spoof of Joe McCarthy in the 1950s.
Yeah, it was our comment on the whole thing. We'd go next door to a bar at noontime and watch the proceedings and then transpose everything that happened into the soap episode the next morning. rated it absolute dead on McCarthy, and we just followed the pattern of their questions and answers and applied it to Mary backstage.
I love how you both, and Ray perhaps a little more, if I'm right here, would have female characters, but not really go that far out of your way to do female voices.
Never in drag. Ray did the main female voice was Mary Magoon, as you mentioned, right. And then he also did Mary backstage.
Well, I want to listen to a scene in which he's playing someone's mother.
Okay.
And your character comes in the room. She summoned her son in the room. And I can't, lost to my memory is the skit, but I want you to listen to the humor. Because I don't want to ask you about that.
Come in and close the door, Rodney. I have something important to discuss with you.
I'd like to oblige, Mother, but there's no door in this room to close. If you'll notice, it's merely an archway of the English Tudor style with some scroll work above.
Oh, never mind. I know what it looks like. Just sit down.
Now, well, when I listened to that scene, Bob Elliott, all I could think of was the scene from Airplane where one character says to the other, "You better tell the captain we've got to land as soon as we can. This woman has to be gotten to a hospital." "A hospital," says the stewardess. "What is it?" "It's a big building with patients, but that's not important right now." I mean, I heard echoes of Bob and Ray in that Airplane scene. And when I hear that scene, we just heard it. Felt it echoed it. Do you hear echoes of your work and other work?
I do, yeah. But I think anybody who's been in it as long as we were will say the same thing.
Do you think that, you know, as we listen to some of these skits unfold, I mean, it takes time to let it unfold.
Yeah.
Do you think that, you know, there's not that attention span for that anymore?
Yeah, I think probably. We did. We had time to kill.
You all started because you were doing rain delay fill.
Yes, and that was one big delay. We used to use a desk drawer as a sound effect for a door opening, and if things got dull, we'd open pull the drawer out, and the door would open, and somebody would come in. I don't know, Robin. We just looked at everything around us, and we seemed to have the same outlook on everything that we saw. It was great chemistry between us.
Yeah. You know, we mentioned, of course, that Ray Goulding passed away in 90.
Yeah.
Can you explain what that was? Because it seemed instant, and I'm sure you miss it.
Oh, I do greatly. I did a few things after he passed away, and it wasn't really fun. Mm-hmm. I mean, working that closely with someone for so long, it's a marriage, you know.
What would you say was that chemical ingredient?
I don't know. I think it's a magical thing. The kibitzing got longer and longer each day until we were really doing a show. And
we've been saying here it was sort of the car talk of its day without cars.
Yeah.
Well, Bob Elliott, we so appreciate your time. We so appreciate the, decades of work.
I appreciate you saying that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
The Komodo dragon is the world's largest living lizard. It's a ferocious carnivora found on the steep-sloped island of Komodo in the Lesser Sunda chain of the Indonesian archipelago and the nearby islands of Rinja, Padar, and Flores.
Where do they come from?
Some more classic Bob and Ray. Bob Elliott's 85th birthday is this Wednesday. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
World's largest living lizard is found on the island of Komodo in the Lesser Sunda chain of the Indonesian archipelago and the nearby islands of Rinja, Padar, and Flores. Now, we have two in this country that were given to us some years ago by the late former premier of Indonesia.